Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God, his kingdom. When we talk about the challenges our country is facing, often we look overseas. And yet, a very serious set of challenges to, well, everything we hold dear, our constitutional republic, the liberties that our Constitution guarantees, the nation itself, are increasingly at risk from domestic forces at work, sometimes mostly behind the scenes. A man who has carefully studied all of this and written powerfully about it is our first guest. His name is Jonathan Emord. He is a constitutional attorney, avocation. He is also the author of a really important book, very much relevant to this topic, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. And get this, he is also the author of a new book aimed at children, but also adults as well, entitled How Joe Biden Stole Christmas. And Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, too. Jonathan, congratulations on this newest foray into public education. It's great to have it, and great to have you with us as well.
Great to be with you, Frank.
So, Jonathan, you've written recently about what you call the deep state and the impact that it is having on our liberties. And it came to mind in connection with something that is very much of concern to me, and I'm sure to many in our audience as well, and you as well, certainly, I'm certain. And that is what this sort of permanent bureaucracy in our government is doing at the moment, both in its own right and through advisory boards and the like, to foist upon our country, and now most especially our children, very problematic experimental gene therapies that have been called vaccines, but are really, I think, untested, inadequately tested, at least unproven, and in a great many cases, especially for younger people, dangerous drug therapies. What are we to make of the fact that we're now being told by an advisory committee of the Centers for Disease Control that every child from 5 on up must be injected with these therapies if they are to go to school to get an education?
It's outrageous. It's a huge violation of both parental rights and the individual liberty of the children. It's a power grab that is characteristic of the deep state. The deep state has operated essentially since the progressive era, but since the 1880s and the Interstate Commerce Commission, the deep state has dwelled rather extensively in the administrative agencies, bureaus, and departments of the government. And now we have this cohesive effort to essentially destroy our country, characterized by the open border policy, Mayorkas using his power to keep that border open, allow terrorists in, drug trafficking, sex trafficking, ruin this country that way, destroy property, destroy people's livelihoods. But this attack on kids is an outrage that may well not sit well with the American people. What they're doing is putting on the vaccine schedule, the COVID-19 vaccine, to make it a requirement for entry into school for a child to prove that they've been vaccinated with it. The evidence is rather clear on the COVID vaccine in kids. It is extremely hazardous for kids, and there is no upside benefit that can be discerned with any reliability. The vaccine has been shown to increase myocarditis, endocarditis risk. It has increased clotting risk. It has long-term consequences that have not been established. The CDC is withheld from the scientific community and the public, the data that it says it's relying upon to justify inclusion of this into the vaccine schedule. And it is, as you point out, a biological experiment that they wish to perform on the entire body of children in this country. Any parent that is conscientious would deprive their child from this wretched vaccine and would not have their children go to school if it was required that they take it. And the CDC has lied to us from the start of this pandemic with their false representations. There's no basis for parents to trust what they're being told from the CDC, particularly when the CDC won't even supply parents or the scientific community with the supposed evidence of safety and efficacy that they have for kids. The scientific community is baffled because they don't see that evidence at all. It's not in the published literature. The literature points in the other direction.
Yeah, as does this document dump that Pfizer was obliged to make, having tried to keep it under seal for 75 years. It's out. Our friend Dr. Naomi Wolf and a team that has been assembled by her and Steve Bannon and War Room on this network to go through those documents is really strongly suggestive that there are extraordinary problems with these so-called vaccines, the Pfizer's and, for that matter, Moderna and Johnson & Johnson as well. And that inflicting them on our kids is tantamount to not only not protecting them, but doing real harm to them, perhaps to the peril of their lives as well.
And recognize that there is no need. What we see over and over again is that kids tolerate very well the virus and they acquire natural immunity, the most effective immunity against the virus in future. So there's absolutely no need. And that, you know, it's virtually unheard of for children to die from COVID-19. It happens, but it's extraordinarily rare. It's even more rare for children to die from COVID-19 than it is from the common flu.
This is such an important point. Let me ask you, you're an attorney and you may or may not have the specialized knowledge that this question requires, but I'm told that one of the considerations that may be operating here in terms of foisting this mandate on children has to do with liability, and not only liability with respect to the children, but throughout their lives, and for that matter, adults as well. Can you speak to that point, Jonathan Emord? Because it further adds to the outrage, it seems to me, of what the big pharma controlled regulatory agency nexus has brought us to thus far, if that were to be the case.
Well, the Vaccine Compensation Fund supplies great deal of protection to the pharmaceutical industry in its promotion of vaccines. It removes from them the liability associated with vaccination. This was separately done for COVID-19. They can't be sued for the adverse effects associated with COVID-19. You're left to suing physicians who administer the drug and so on. So it is a situation where they have no disincentive and have every economic incentive to make this a regular part of our lives where they are provided the funding for it over and over and over again. This whole boosting idea, and the idea, you know, you start the children when they're infants and small, and then you continuously boost them. This is insane, particularly because the vaccine has proven itself so woefully inadequate and to have risks that are remarkable. The spike proteins, by the way, are created genetically by this vaccine in the human body, are as severe, if not more severe, than the virus itself.
Right.
And are inducing
the so-called cure being worse than the disease by far. Hold on just one second, Jonathan Emord. We're going to come back to you to talk a bit more about that. How all of this has come to pass, which brings in some foreign influences as well, and what the implications are for all of us. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If Team Biden were bent on provoking the American people to revolt against their government, possibly violently, a very promising technique would be to threaten bodily harm to the nation's children. The natural instinct of human mama bears can have dramatic political consequences. Throughout history, dads, too, have reflexively reacted forcefully to threats to their offspring's safety and well-being. So, what are we to make of the highly politicized U.S. public health system's impending decision to compel America's students to be inoculated with experimental COVID-19 gene therapies, masquerading as vaccines when they are known to be ineffective in protecting young people from the original SARS-CoV-2 virus, let alone its mutants? Worse yet, evidence continues to accumulate that these gene therapies hurt, maim, and in some cases kill children, adolescents, and young adults. A dangerous jab cannot be required to attend school, period. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We're continuing our conversation with one of the most thoughtful people that I have come across and am pleased to present to all of you, Jonathan Emord. He is by trade a constitutional attorney and an author now of several books, including The Authoritarians and How Joe Biden Stole Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa Too. We're going to be continuing a conversation that began on the other side of this block that I think is tremendously important, especially if you are a parent or a grandparent, for that matter, with small children who you're being told must now take aboard an experimental, ineffective, and potentially quite damaging gene therapy in order to get an education in America. And I don't know if this is actually going to be finalized and approved all the way through the system, but as we speak, an advisory board has unanimously recommended this course of action for reasons that I think defy understanding at the moment. Jonathan, I just wanted to ask in this connection, you were speaking about the spike protein, which the jab injects, and it happens now, we know, to not stay at the point where the injection is taking place. It goes all over the body. It gets into your organs. It gets into your reproductive systems and will be with these children for life, especially if they are boosted, as would logically flow from this mandate every 6 months or every year or whatever else. And by the way, you know, it's important to note that Dr. Robert Malone, who helped invent this mRNA, as it's called, technology, is dead set against all of this and very worried that, particularly as they're talking about not only using this technology to insert those spike proteins in connection with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, but also to use it as a vehicle for getting other vaccinations into our system. This just seems as though there's a sort of Frankenstein quality to what's afoot. But we also know, Jonathan, that the Chinese were involved in various aspects of all of this, not only setting loose on us this biological warfare attack, but also apparently manufacturing some of these vaccines or otherwise helping with their development. And, you know, to have a mortal enemy like the Chinese Communist Party playing any role in these kinds of medical and public health operations is truly mind-boggling and I think fraught with peril. What do you think?
Well, it's an example of the greatest betrayal of the United States in our history that Dr. Fauci, with full awareness that he was dealing with the enemy of the United States that had an active and very aggressive biological weapons program, including at the Wuhan lab, And given the prior history of its development of SARS-type viruses in the Beijing lab, nonetheless proceeded, even with full knowledge that there were inadequate containment, that it was likely to escape. He even said in response to an interview in 2014 that he was asked the question, well, isn't this gain-of-function research going to place the world at risk? Aren't we going to be at higher risk of a global pandemic? And in response to that, he said, well, there are certain risks we have to take in order to advance scientific research. This man is a comparable to a Joseph Mengele, but he has killed, you know, there's so much blood on his hands for what he has done, but it's the ultimate Benedict Arnold betrayal of the United States. It is vastly beyond what Benedict Arnold could ever have conceived possible through his betrayal. So
Mengele, having been, of course, a Nazi doctor who was notorious for horrific experimentation and well, the deaths of Jews and others in the prison camps of Nazi Germany, and we're definitely, I think, in that space, except as you say, on steroids with Dr. Fauci. And I do want to commend to our listeners two things: one, a book by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., entitled The Real Anthony Fauci, which has now been turned into a motion picture, a two-part documentary. I've had a chance to see parts of the first stage of it, and I'm looking forward to the second. It is available, by the way, for free now at therealanthonyfaucimovie.com. And I strongly commend that you take advantage of this. It's only for the next few days, but it's very worthwhile. And particularly for those who found the book itself heavy sledding, because it's so carefully documented and so, well, lawyerly in its writing style to indict Anthony Fauci for, as you say, betrayal of our country. Among other things, this movie is much more accessible and very, very important to take aboard. Let me just ask you, you mentioned, Jonathan E. Moore, that the Chinese Communist Party is our mortal enemy. And I couldn't agree with you more than that is the case. And this idea, we'll talk more about it shortly in the course of the show with Kevin Freeman. But your thoughts on the extent to which, when we were told if we just engaged with China, we helped make them rich, for that matter, make them more powerful, they would become more like us. As we've been watching in this 20th Party Congress, notably in the speech of Xi Jinping, who will shortly, we're told, be coronated as a kind of new communist emperor of China for life, they have, if anything, made us more like them. And I think your points about the deep state, the administrative state, the unaccountable way in which we're being governed these days, we don't even know who the president of the United States is, the effective president, let alone have much of a say in what he's doing instead of our representative, you know, legislative process in the Congress. When you look at what's been done here, it seems as though there's an awful lot more betrayal going on than just Tony Fauci's, is there not?
That's certainly true. The Chinese have their tentacles in every part of our society, every aspect of industry, every aspect of the federal government, of our military. We're talking about, with the complicity of leaders of this country and in leaders in business, we're talking about an entity that has intentionally insinuated itself into our whole fabric since the door was opened by Richard Nixon to China. And the reality is that they will spare no effort to undermine and destroy our country, and they are gleeful at our own complicity in that effort. And indeed, we are in a much more perilous world because we have not responded with the kind of rigor that we need to defend our country, our republic, and individual liberty against the abuses being visited upon us whether it's TikTok taking over our children, whether it's their use of our open border to insinuate into our country all sorts of malfeasance through actors who mean to destroy us, or whether it's paying Joe Biden bribes through his son Hunter Biden to the tune of millions, including now we know an interest-free loan of massive sums that he has used in a joint bank account with his son to finance his own expenditures. That violates the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. And he's never been held to account. There is no independent prosecutor. It's an utter disaster, but it is characteristic of really a vast and extensive effort across all areas to completely ruin our country and make us vulnerable to takeover.
The authoritarians at work domestically as well as abroad. Jonathan Emord, thank you for that important book, The Authoritarians, as well as your comments today and the great work you're doing. I look forward to our next visit soon. Keep up the good work in the meantime, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with John Mills about our election integrity, the lack thereof, and its exploitation by the Chinese communists, among others. Stay tuned for more right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're going to visit for a little bit with a friend and colleague now of some time, a man whose judgment and expertise we value highly. His name is Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired. He has been not only a special forces operator during his time in uniform, but an operator at the highest levels of the U.S. government in the civilian side after he retired from the Army. He has been, among other things, a student of, practitioner of, and overseer concerning the cybersecurity of the United States. John Mills, it's great to have you with us. There's so much going on in that part of the battle space, not least in the election arena. Talk to us a little bit about what you have been warning about and recommending be done to assure the integrity of our elections, especially in light of what happened to us in 2020.
Well, Frank, as I outline in my book, The Nation Will Follow, and my fight against the deep state realizing personal colleagues were spying on candidate and then President Trump and then getting in front of the Durham investigation, all of this is based and built upon the shoulders of our county. So it is so important if you're mad at the globalists, which you should be, if we're not happy with the globalists, which you should be. Richard Haass just resigned from CFR, made some, I disagree with his statements. He essentially blamed MAGA as the biggest threat. No, sorry. It's American citizens involved at the county level. American citizens own their county level government, own the state and federal government, and the entire American constitutional process, including the sacred voting process, is built upon the county level, as I've had to do in literally thousands of white papers at the National Security Council for the President, for the Secretary of Defense, as I've analyzed and taught myself on the voting process. A lot of it we're missing and misunderstanding. It's all about the county. It's all about right where we live. So in your own county, don't get mad at Maricopa. Don't get mad at Fulton. In my state, I can't get mad at Fairfax. I don't live in Fairfax. I live in Prince William County. You must exert 98% of your effort in your county, and by asking reasoned, simple questions, writing reasoned letters, asterisk, we need to write better. I've had lots and lots of citizen groups around the nation show me the letters they're writing. As a university professor, I'd also say let's brush up on our English composition, and let's write effective action-oriented letters without being accusatory and bringing in tangential topics. Focus on elections. In my county, myself, but with others, we now have our first criminal indictment, felony indictment of a former registrar in our county. The current registrar was the one who threw her under the bus. And now with a letter, a reasoned, simple letter to the sheriff and the attorney general, the current registrar has decided to jump out of the airplane without getting their parachute on first. Okay, guys, ask reasoned questions. It's amazing what happens. Even if your county is clean, clean officials act very differently when they know reasoned citizens are watching them and asking logical questions. Anybody would behave like that.
John, give us an example quickly, if you can, of what kinds of questions you think are in order, given what we've seen in the way of election integrity problems to date.
Well, one of the things I would ask, I would FOIA or whatever it is called in your state, because there's different terms. At the federal level, we call them FOIAs, Freedom of Information Act requests, but they can be called open records requests. There's various terms for them. Ask for the contracts for all the election machines, tabulators, poll books, election services, and read through them. Because guess what? Your county officials sure aren't reading these. And you'll find real good jewels and nuggets. With my second registrar, I pointed out several things like his broad authority to inspect the machines and the requirement to keep all of the election artifacts, which refers to paper ballots, for 5 years, well beyond the federal requirement. They've never exercised that clear contractual clause. I asked about the rolls. A FOIA of jury duty rejections showed at a minimum 6% of the people on the rolls, because we draw our jury duty from the rolls, aren't not lawful to be voting. Well, how did they get on the rolls? So the number one duty of any registrar or recorder, whatever they're called, is to keep a clean roll. This is America. We can keep a clean roll. But with many registrars, it's always, oh, well, a 5 to 8% error rate. So what? Who cares? 5 to 8% error rate. Most of these elections are in 1 to 3%. Come on. This is ridiculous. It is the number one sworn duty of most registrar of all registrars or what recorders to keep a clean roll. Okay.
How is it that these rolls are not so clean, John?
Well, a number of states are involved in this national system called ERIC, which we need to destroy ERIC and get every state out of the ERIC system. Every state needs to individually be responsible for their rolls. We can't have ERIC remotely adding and deleting names. That is insanity. Jay Valentine has done an incredible work in this area. But this is not difficult. This is database management 101. Okay, and every time there's a change, there needs to be an artifact that demonstrates who legally made that change and why. And everybody's going, oh, well, there's just so many things I can't control it. Well, my registrar was making $170,000 a year. If they can't do it for $170,000 a year, let's find somebody else. And that's registrar number two is now ejected. Let's get registrar number three and see if they can do this.
John, you have a background in cybersecurity, as I mentioned. To the extent that this data is out there, electronically accessible, what, in your professional judgment, is the likelihood that, among others, the Chinese Communist Party may have access to it and be able to manipulate it and, in turn, manipulate elections themselves?
Well, now it has been established as fact, not conjecture, fact, that with the Poll Chief software suite by Kennec Corporation, Eugene Yu in Michigan, who's now under criminal indictment and has been arrested and it has been extradited to California by, of all people, George Gascon, Soros liberal crazy DA of Los Angeles. That is the direct line to China. This is now and it proves, once again, Donald J. Trump was right. Okay, and it's now showing that more than Poll Chief was the personal data, like me, I'm an election officer. I work behind the counter. It shows that, hey, guess what? My bank account information was in China. So is in China. And that Poll Chief is connected to other software elements. All this stuff is stored in the cloud. And what's all these databases are in the cloud of election data, of election rolls. All this stuff is stored in cloud environments off-site, which means there's all kinds of wonderful opportunity to go lateral between these data sets. And come on, this is way above the knowledge level of most registrars. And so you know, one of my proposals is every registrar must be legally accountable for any changes in any databases and must demonstrate independent ability to validate and verify all of this activity. Not the contractor, the registrar must demonstrate an independent ability to validate all of this data in IT, which is currently obvious. It's way above the head of most of them.
John Leslie, one corrective, at least to the voting process itself, has been just a return to old-fashioned paper ballots, hand-counted paper ballots under supervision. What are the chances that we could yet do something like that in this election cycle?
For the smaller counties, I think it is still doable. And I will point to Cochise County, Arizona, as a possibility. For some of the larger counties, maybe a little bit of a problem, but citizens surging and demonstrating decisive vigilance, I think will be a huge deterrence. But I think paper only is the way to go. Other countries, France, Taiwan, other countries do it. The Chinese have broken into every other IT network, but the election machine companies say they're safe. I mean, if they're so safe, they should be in charge of the nuclear launch codes, because the Chinese have broken into everything else. But somehow, magically, election machines are secure. That is utter silliness, and that is not the way to run elections.
So when you hear officials in the Department of Homeland Security, for example, insisting that our elections are secure, the last one they said the most secure ever, given what you've just described in terms of the high probability that the Chinese are in fact able to take advantage of what we were putting on the cloud, or for that matter in servers in China, for heaven's sakes, it would seem as though we have to treat such comments, such assurances, with a great deal of skepticism. No?
Yeah, Jenny Easterly at CISA, who has a long history in this area, perhaps back to the earliest break and enter back during the early days of the war on terror, they have no idea, and they need to publicly demonstrate exactly with clarity they are looking for. I have very low confidence that CISA, NSA, Cyber Command has any idea what they're looking for in this area. They are, frankly, totally focused on shutting down Russia and China in Ukraine and in the Pacific.
We have to shut this down for the moment. John Mills, thank you for joining us. We'll be back for updates with you in the days to come. Thank you for your work. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If Team Biden were bent on provoking the American people to revolt against their government, possibly violently, a very promising technique would be to threaten bodily harm to the nation's children. The natural instinct of human mama bears can have dramatic political consequences. Throughout history, dads, too, have reflexively reacted forcefully to threats to their offspring's safety and well-being. So, what are we to make of the highly politicized U.S. public health system's impending decision to compel America's students to be inoculated with experimental COVID-19 gene therapies, masquerading as vaccines when they are known to be ineffective in protecting young people from the original SARS-CoV-2 virus, let alone its mutants? Worse yet, evidence continues to accumulate that these gene therapies hurt, maim, and in some cases kill children, adolescents, and young adults. A dangerous jab cannot be required to attend school, period. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're going to be visiting in this block on a couple of issues that should be very much top of mind for all of us, but are not necessarily so, except for our guest. His name is Kevin Freeman. He's one of our regulars, I'm very pleased to say, and the host of his own television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. It's one of the best products on television anywhere. You can find it at Blaze and other platforms. Kevin is the author of several best-selling books, including Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and most recently, According to Plan. Really imperative that you take that information in the newest book aboard, because it really does explain what's afoot in our country. Kevin, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us, as always.
Thank you, Frank. It's always good to see you.
I want to talk about a piece of the plan that seems to be operating intensively at the moment. Tucker Carlson, interestingly enough, last night had a powerful monologue in which he started by talking about how the Houthis in Rwanda worked themselves into a lather that ultimately resulted in the genocide of enormous numbers of Tutsis, two tribes in that country at war, by virtue of the kind of incitement that was done by radio stations that were provoking a sort of racist or tribal enmity against the Tutsis. And he, you know, introduced in conjunction with that the kind of programming that is now the regular fare at MSNBC. I might also throw into the mix NPR and other outlets, in which sort of hatred of whites, something that is, I think, at the core of the so-called critical race theory, is now being endlessly promoted. And he warned that, you know, we could well find ourselves in the not-too-distant future in some kind of racist civil war that would be obviously horrific, as the genocide in Rwanda was. You've done some programming on this, on Economic War Room, about, you know, this whole thesis that this is a racist country. It's systemically racist. It goes back to the original sin of the founding fathers, some of whom were slave owners and so on. What do you make of what's afoot here, Kevin? Is this basically a sort of racist version of cultural Marxism aimed at our destruction, or is there truth to these allegations?
Well, first, Frank, let's just put it out there. America may be the least racist nation on earth. And that's true. I have many friends who come from various cultures, from India, from Japan, and others. And they remark at how well integrated all of the different racial backgrounds are in our nation. And the idea that we are the most racist nation on earth is ludicrous. The founders knew that slavery was a problem. Several of them were proponents of it. The founder of the Democratic Party, for one, Andrew Jackson, couldn't wait to buy slaves. So there's no question that there has been racism in this country, as there has been in every society around the world. But we fought a war to end racism. We had Tim Barton in the War Room recently, and he talked about, you know, the equality ball where people would attend the Equality Ball with the idea of ending racism in the late 1700s, early 1800s, the people that wrote our Constitution. So the idea that we are the most racist nation on earth is ludicrous. It is being pushed for racist reasons with the idea of taking control of our country. I mean, it absolutely is an effort to unseat the existing power structure, which is less racist, and replace it with a more racist power structure.
Yeah. And Kevin, as you know, one of the countries that would stand to benefit most from that kind of fratricidal conflict internal to the United States would, of course, be the Chinese Communist Party, which presides over a nation that, under its misrule, is arguably the most racist in the world today. This so-called Han supremacism is evident in the official party line, as well as a lot of its behavior. And look no further than the colonizing of Africa and the demeaning of blacks that is entailed in all of that. And I guess I just would ask, Kevin, as you look at the prospects for the success of this divide and conquer strategy, whether it's emanating from the Chinese Communist Party's United Work Front Department, or it's being homebrewed by, those promoting this critical race theory indoctrination. If we don't turn this around, if we don't stop this kind of incitement, notably through outlets like MSNBC and NPR, are we doomed to this playing out as horrifically as it did in Rwanda, do you think?
Well, it depends on our cultural cohesion. For example, I was at a pastor's conference recently in Idaho. I mean, I just flew back from it last night, and there were pastors from all ethnic backgrounds involved in the conference. And the commonality of believing in liberty, security, values, raising kids according to Western civilization, Christian, Judeo-Christian principles. That's how we put a stop to this, when we realize that we share more in common than we have opposite. I mean, Dr. Carson once told me, he said, it is a very unsophisticated brain that looks at the skin color or the outward appearance of another being and makes a swift judgment based on that. Human beings have far greater capacity beyond that. So we have hope. The hope is that we return to our senses, that we recognize Western civilization, and we realize the enemy is trying to divide us. A house divided against itself cannot stand. That's in the Bible, and Abraham Lincoln said it also. And the idea is we've got to return to what we share in common. We want to raise our children in a great environment. We want to have a good economy. We want to stand for the eternal principles of liberty, security, and values.
Yeah. And as Tucker pointed out, the further we get away from this idea that, it's really inherent in what Ben Carson told you, the content of our character being what defines us as a people and what we use to judge others, if we are to judge them at all. We certainly want to do it on the basis of what they do with their lives, not what the accident of their genetics might have made in terms of their outward appearance. Kevin, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you a bit about a couple of other things, including a chip ban in China, imposed by the Biden administration, what it portends. We'll do that right after this. Stay tuned for more with Kevin Friedman. We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with one of our favorite guests. His name is Kevin Friedman. He is a chartered financial analyst by training, but has developed an expertise that has made him really one of the country's preeminent authorities on the business of economic warfare, both that being waged against the United States, notably by the Chinese Communist Party, and that taking place elsewhere, including, it would appear, now at the hands of the Biden administration, amazingly enough. and against the Chinese, especially. Kevin, talk a little bit about this ban that has been instituted recently against both the export of chip technology, chips, and I think the equipment for manufacturing them, as well as any other help by U.S. nationals to the Chinese communists. What's that about, and what are its implications, do you think?
Well, there's a number of things, Frank. One is, I would argue it's a little late in the process, although a potentially necessary step. It's going to be a very important, nuanced approach that we need to take as a nation. The Chinese are dependent on American ingenuity, and they either acquire it through purchasing it, they bribe for it, or they outright steal it. The reality of it is that most advanced technology in chip making has come from the United States. Unfortunately, it's held in large degree in Taiwan, something that the Chinese have their eyes set on. And the risk here is that by provoking this with this ban, we're provoking them into a desire to move faster and not slower into Taiwan. And I guess it's been compared, you mentioned to me earlier, Steve Bannon compared it to the idea that we banned oil to the Japanese and that resulted in Pearl Harbor. Whether that was intentional or unintentional, you know, history will have to be the guide on that. But it is possible here. You could look down a scenario where we ban chip making equipment, and so they say we'll just go take it in Taiwan and provokes a war. So it is a very dangerous time indeed. We certainly can't allow the Chinese to continue to steal American technology and profit from it. We also can't allow them to steal it and turn it into weapons to be used against us.
Yeah, we have to, whatever the upshot of this particular decision may prove to be, Kevin, we have to be weaning ourselves from the dependency we have on so many of these Chinese supply chains, do we not?
Absolutely. And the whole idea of globalism and the interconnectivity of the world in a kumbaya moment that really emerged during the Clinton years is ludicrous. We see nation states competing against one another on a continuing basis, and the World Economic Forum put aside for a second. And the reality of it is that there is economic warfare, and it's a natural part of human history. We've ignored it for far too long, and now we find ourselves dependent on our enemies in many cases for the very technology we need to have to defend ourselves from those very same enemies.
In some cases, literally, our Defense Department and military are taking as essential ingredients for their defenses of our country equipment and materials and other things supplied by the Chinese communists, at least for the moment. Let me pivot to another kind of economic warfare that you've been addressing, notably by tweeting out a very important piece by our friend Ben Weingarten, also a regular guest here, Securing America. It was about an action that PayPal announced, then I think in the face of a lot of criticism, has walked away from, I gather. But it was a window into a phenomenon called debanking, Kevin, that's quite ominous. Tell us what's going on in that regard and its implications.
Well, essentially, PayPal, if you take them at their word, they accidentally released a draft statement that they had drafted that said that they were going to fine individuals for hate speech and intolerable behavior on the internet. And if they caught you doing it, they would take $2,500 out of your account, your money, and just fine you for it as if they were the government themselves. Now, it's scary on two fronts. Number one, private business would be doing, for example, if you said that vaccines don't work or masks don't work or any government policy was bad, that would stifle political speech. And then they said, well, it was just a draft. We didn't mean to release it. And it's like, the fact that you drafted it shows exactly what you're thinking. And this is what we would have if everyone were dependent on PayPal, this is what we'd have. The good news is you can leave PayPal and go somewhere else. But a central bank digital currency proposed by the Biden administration would mean that all of our money would be subject to that kind of control, not by a private entity that you could fire and move to another, but by the federal government. They could literally stifle free speech. If you said something wrong, they could make the money in your bank account disappear. This is a frightening domestic economic warfare trend that we're seeing, where banks cancel Kanye West. You know, he wears White Lives Matter. I guess that's not politically acceptable. And I understand he had 10-year-old tweets where he said things that were not politically correct. You know, he said some maybe terrible things. I haven't read the tweets, but there are members of Congress saying similar things in Congress today, and they're not being debanked. So it really is a frightening form of economic warfare where you can be debanked. Your money can be taken from you because they disagree with what you think.
Yeah. And Ben points out that this is redolent of what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing to its people with its so-called social credit system. And we're seeing it through means like the vaccine passports and mandates and masks and all the rest of the so-called China model that they were able to get the West, including our country, largely to adopt. In the aftermath of the attack, the biological warfare attack, as we call it in our Team B3 book, which you were a co-author, Kevin Freeman, they have moved that social credit system, or at least the rudiments of it, the foundational elements of it, into our country, have they not? And isn't that of concern in this regard as well?
Yeah, and I wouldn't argue that China is pulling the strings for PayPal, but the same basic methodology for controlling the citizens is present in the PayPal effort and present in Chase debanking Kanye West and so forth. We're using monetary means to control the population, and I deal with this all the time.
You do all the time on Economic War Room, especially with your battle plans. I strongly commend both to our audience. EconomicWarRoom.com is where you can find it all. Kevin Freeman, thanks for joining us. Come back to us soon. I hope the same will be true of you. Same time next time on Securing America.